You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In 2013, a group of Kenyan claimants issued proceedings in the English High Court seeking damages for personal injuries against the United Kingdom government. They said that these had been inflicted in Kenya by both British soldiers and employees of the colonial government during the period of the emergency from 1952 to 1960. The claims raised issues at three levels. First, should the court extend time for bringing these otherwise time-barred claims? Second, if it did, could the individuals prove the facts of the assaults alleged? Third, if the assaults were proved, was the United Kingdom liable in law? The group ultimately numbered 40,000. A group litigation order was made. 25 test claims were selected for trial. In this action, the United Kingdom put the claimants to proof of all of their allegations and made no admissions. The court directed that it should hear all the evidence, such as there was, from claimants and defendant. Only then would it proceed to determine as a first issue whether to exercise its discretion to extend time pursuant to Section 33 of the 1980 Limitation Act. Guy Mansfield, QC of One Crown Office Row, acted for the Foreign Office in the action. Guy, many thanks for coming on the podcast to explain the complex web of facts and indeed absence of facts in this tale. So could you give us some idea of what the essential claim was all about?
The essential individual claims by each of the test claimants were damages for personal injury by reason of trespass to the person, that is, assaults. The individual claimants alleged that the United Kingdom government was liable not only for alleged assaults by British soldiers, but also for assaults by employees of the colonial government of Kenya. It was said that the United Kingdom was liable for the torts of assault through any one of three individual routes. That is, negligence, or vicarious liability, or joint liability through the common design of the colonial and United Kingdom governments to restore law and order.
So let's back up a bit and talk about how these sort of claims can be limited. I mean, it's obvious that we have to have some way of preventing stale claims from being litigated far into the future. What was the thinking behind the particular limitation for personal injury claims?
An action for personal injury must be brought within 3 years from the date on which the cause of action accrued, or the date of knowledge, if that's later, of the person injured. The causes of action accrued in the case of Test Claimant 34 in the 1950s and possibly into 1960. The claimant had not alleged that his date of knowledge was any later than when the injury was allegedly caused. The purpose of the Limitation Act is to protect defendants from stale claims which it would otherwise be unjustified given the remove of time. That is particularly relevant when documents or witnesses are lost to time and these impede a defendant's ability to defend. Depending on the issues and the nature of the evidence going into them, the longer the delay, the more likely and the greater the prejudice to the defendant. It is also based on the belief that a time comes when, for better or for worse, a defendant should be effectively relieved from the risk of having to resist stale claims. The length of the delay is important not so much for itself as for the effect it has had. To what extent has the defendant been disadvantaged in his investigation of the claim and or the assembly of evidence in respect of issues of both liability and quantum? As Lord Brown, in the well-known case of A and Hoare, said, by no means everyone who brings a late claim for damages, however genuine his complaint may in fact be, can reasonably expect the court to exercise the Section 33 discretion in his favour. As Lord Justice Tomlinson later said in Davis and the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, Section 33 is a corrective for injustice where the circumstances allow. It is, of course, for the claimant to establish those circumstances.
Returning to this litigation, one of the things that the judge in the latest case was at pains to emphasise was that this litigation was a court process in a civil claim, not a public inquiry. Why was that important?
That's because there are fundamental differences between court proceedings in any form of conventional public inquiry. This was not an inquiry into how things could be better managed in the future. Indeed, the defendant had admitted to Parliament through the then Secretary of State, Mr. William Hague, in 2013, that there were abuses in Kenya during the emergency, as a result of which people suffered grievously. That, as this court held, was the background. But claims for damages had to stand or fall on established principles of civil litigation. The court's focus in these circumstances was on the case as presented by each individual test claimant. The court's task is, in these circumstances, governed by rules of law and procedure. Here, in these cases, the court was concerned with a trial of serious allegations with a view to reach conclusive findings of fact in respect of which the test claimants sought to recover damages from the defendant. It was not engaged in an inquiry. It was for each claimant to establish that there could yet be a fair trial of the facts and issues in respect of his or her individual case. Only then could each claimant succeed in getting an extension of time under Section 33. The court in such a case is therefore engaged upon a forensic, fact-finding exercise within a legal framework. It needs to determine whether the claimant can make out his claim and whether that exercise can be done fairly.
This was an extremely long delay, as you said, over 50 years. And in these circumstances, the claimant has to establish that there are good reasons for the delay in starting proceedings. What were the reasons advanced here?
As the lawyers listening to this will know, Section 33, subsection 3, subsection A of the Act refers to the length of and reasons for delay. They're therefore a specific matter for consideration by the court. The courts have held that they must undertake a subjective inquiry on the facts of the particular case and determine whether the reasons given by a particular claimant are good or bad. Authoritative decisions have shown that claimants must themselves give reasons for the delay. Any justification for not having disclosed the allegations earlier is not considered to be self-proving. The claimant, in this case, had given no evidence about the reasons for his delay, although certain matters had been referred to in the pleadings. The same applied to the other test claimants. The judge held that it was unsatisfactory for the court to be asked to draw inferences when a claimant had given written and oral evidence but had said nothing on his or her reasons for delay. It's important to note that at a trial of the issue of limitation, a pleading which has been supported by a statement of truth, but not by more, is not evidence of the matters set out in it.
So we've looked at the whole situation from the claimant's side and the onus being on them to adduce proper reasons and so on. Let's now turn to the defendants and consider the effect of the delay, such as witness availability and quality of evidence.
These issues were at the heart of the defendant's assertion that time should not be extended. Key factors were first witness availability and the quality of oral evidence, and second, the effect of the availability or unavailability of documents. As to witnesses, a great many were dead, well over 90% on any basis, or they could not be traced. No particularly high-ranking officials could be produced. If the claim had been brought earlier, witnesses could have given evidence of the prevailing circumstances, of the systems and the processes at the time. Moreover, the alleged tortfeasors and more proximate witnesses might have been identified and could have given evidence themselves. Also, importantly, so far as the oral evidence was concerned, the claimant's own recollection was palpably weakened, and his evidence weakened accordingly. As to the documents, what was clear was that there was a great deal which was not clear. The judge talked about known unknowns and unknown unknowns. Apart from what the court had, it is unknown what was destroyed in Kenya, what was returned to the United Kingdom, what remains in Kenya, or has been lost or destroyed there. The judge held in an earlier judgment that the defendant was not to be blamed in any way for such loss and or destruction as had occurred. Despite massive searches by the defendant, there were no documents at all relating to the fact of specific detention in camps or other matters of importance. So a claimant's evidence of detention could neither be confirmed nor challenged. There was no contemporary medical evidence in support of the test claimant's injuries or his physical condition at the material time. It was not clear whether such evidence had ever existed. Additionally, there was a lack of other witnesses to support core allegations. It was impossible for the defendant to investigate who might have been responsible if the allegations were true, or to call witnesses to put events in context. As the judge held, if the allegations had been made at the time, or at least very much earlier, they could have been much better investigated. And, perhaps importantly, the claimant's own recollection would also have been fresher and therefore more reliable. In summary, the court had no doubt that the test claimant's evidence had been rendered significantly less cogent by the delay in issuing the claim. The strong probability was that the defendant would have been in a substantially better position to defend the core allegations well into the mid-1960s. Now, it was essentially impossible for the defendant to have any proper opportunity to find documentary or witness evidence with real evidence as to the core allegations.
But the fact that a fair trial can take place is not the end of the matter, is it?
No, that's correct. The prospects of a fair trial are important. The case of Hoare makes that plain. The Limitation Acts are designed to protect defendants from the injustice of having to fight stale claims, especially when any witnesses the defendant might have been able to rely on are not available or have no recollection, and there are no documents to assist in deciding what was done or not done and why. It is therefore particularly relevant whether and to what extent the defendant's ability to defend the claim has in fact been prejudiced by the lapse of time because of the absence of relevant witnesses and documents. Whether a fair trial can take place is a very important question. If it cannot take place, it is very unlikely to be equitable for the defendant to meet the claim. But if a fair trial can take place, that is not the end of the matter. The possibility of a fair trial is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition for the disapplication of the limitation period. The basic question is whether it is fair and just, in all the circumstances, to expect the defendant to meet the claim on the merits, notwithstanding the delay in commencement.
In the case of the test claimants, could the Foreign Office or the claimants' lawyers find any documents relating to their actual detention, let alone the treatment they received or the facts of any of the core allegations?
No. The fact is that in respect of no test claimant, could anyone find any document which actually pointed directly to the detention or treatment of any named test claimant. This absence of evidence provided a compelling foundation for the submission that there could not be a fair trial. But to establish it, the defendant went to great lengths to ascertain which witnesses had been available and to identify them by name and occupation and place at relevant times. This showed that at the time of the events in question, there would have been a range of persons who could have given relevant evidence, and that these persons were no longer available, either because they had plainly died or because they could not be traced. This evidence was given by Foreign Office officials and government lawyers who set out in detail the searches that they had made. It was supported by the trace reports from inquiry agents. So too, although there was a mass of documentation, there was also a dearth of documents such as detention records or dossiers, which would have addressed the individual cases.
So we've looked at the past relevant to this litigation. Let's look at the present and the future. Mr. Justice Stewart's first ruling relates to only one claimant amidst the 40,000 or so in the group litigation order. But presumably his findings would apply with equal force to the other test claimants.
Yes. The first ruling was embodied in a decision handed down on the 2nd of August. At the beginning of October, the Court of Appeal refused the claimant's permission to appeal that hearing. The judge went on then to try the second test case, and on the 21st of November 2018, he gave judgment in that second test case. His reasoning there was essentially the same. The claimants acknowledged that they were unable to argue that any remaining test case could be distinguished materially on its facts. The judge then dismissed all the test cases, that is all 25, and entered judgment dismissing all the claims of the 40,000 members in the group litigation cohort.
And the Court of Appeal refused permission to appeal against Mr. Justice Stewart's ruling, and they said his decision was, in quotes, a masterly synthesis.
Yes, with the greatest respect, I would agree with that. I would, wouldn't I? It runs to 481 paragraphs. In it, the judge reviewed all the legal principles to be extracted from the authorities governing the exercise of the court's discretion under Section 33 of the Limitation Act. He set out and then pulled together the broad facts of the events in Kenya in the 1950s and the emergency in particular, and then he pulled together and identified the particular facts relating to the core allegations in the test case. He then set all this out comprehensively and clearly. Finally, he applied the principles which he had extracted of the law to the facts in question. I recommend that anyone who has to litigate the issue of whether or not there should be an extension of time under Section 33 look carefully at this judgment. You will find its exegesis of the law and principle most useful. It's indeed a masterly synthesis.
In all of this, there's an underlying puzzle, which is why did the judge not decide the limitation issue at a much earlier stage of the proceedings? Why was so much time and money expended on the case before these Section 33 of the Limitation Act discretion question was considered?
In most cases, the question of when to hear the issue of whether or not to extend time is dealt with at a relatively early stage in the proceedings. In this case, or in this group action. The judge held, in accordance with authority, starting with the well-known case of Bryn Allen, that, in fact, it would be better to hear all the facts in the case so that he could better determine, rather than making a guesstimate, what evidence there actually was and wasn't, and identify what was missing, what was not before him, and why that was, and what effect that would have on all the cases. At the time when he made that ruling, it was not what the defendant had sought, but was what the claimants had sought. But we, on behalf of the defendant, came to the view in due course, and it is mentioned in the judgment, that in fact that was undoubtedly the right approach. In a case of this size, it's impossible in a week or 2 week hearing, just on the documents, to make an accurate assessment of what the significant evidence is and what significant evidence is missing and unavailable and how that's come about.
LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.